Hey, everybody. Welcome to the A1 Auto Body Podcast with your host, Nick Sands. Today, I'm talking with my boy, Paul Zagrafos. Paul Zagrafos is a serial entrepreneur who has started multiple companies doing everything from yo-yos to fitness. And he's going to talk to us about his next venture and how COVID affected his last venture and everything in between. How you doing, Paul?
Oh, not too bad. Serial entrepreneur is a good... I'll take that.
I don't remember who I heard referred to as that, but it was probably like 2 years ago. And now every time, I know so many people who that label fits. And definitely one of them.
Hey, I'll take it.
So you, get started with what was the first business you ever opened?
I opened a 24-hour gym that was a franchise, part of a large company. The only, not using a name just so that we can talk about details. And I opened it when I was 23. I opened it with my father. I didn't open it by myself. He was a franchisee for basically, I think he opened his first business in his early 30s. So for a long time. I don't want to get the number wrong, but so he had a bunch of Dunkin' Donuts locations, and he even had a Harley Davidson dealership at one point. And when I was working as a manager of a local gym, selling personal training, managing trainers, that kind of thing, after college, I expressed my interest in opening a business at some point. I wanted to open a gym. And my father, having experience, said, work for somebody, learn how to do it, and then we'll risk our money on it rather than just opening it and learning as I go. And that was good advice. I'm glad we did that. I opened my first location when I was like 23, 24, sort of on the cusp there. And I opened my second location about 4 years later. And then there was just a whole fiasco of events since then that ended up with me closing my club during COVID, which was kind of just the last straw. It wasn't really like the only reason, but yeah, it was definitely the crushing blow. And I've moved on to other things. I did have you mentioned yo-yos. My company is Big Bang Bandoloras. Is the proper way to pronounce it. I just say Bandoloras because I'm lazy, even though it's my company. So
you're the boss. You can do that.
Yeah, exactly. I design in a CAD program, Fusion 360, high-end, very high-precision CNC aluminum and titanium yo-yos. And I have them produced for me at a factory that ships them to me. And then I kind of assemble them and stuff. I mostly do the design work and the marketing and everything. I'm not like working the machinery myself or anything, but so I've been doing that for a couple of years as kind of a side fun thing. It was basically a self-fulfilling art project where if I could sell some of them, it would pay for itself because I don't like to waste money on stuff. I'd rather something kind of be its own revenue source. So I was able to sell yo-yos and still be able to make my own designs, which was fun.
Let's actually, before we get too far down this road, has being a salesman, an entrepreneur, like a business owner, is that something you've always wanted to do, or is that something that you weren't sure about until you got like into your 20s?
It's definitely something that just happened. I think what happens is when you become an adult and you realize that you can't just do whatever you want, you have to do what you're good at in order to succeed because everyone's competing. That was my strength, and it's just kind of what worked and what, like, my first real job, I guess to kind of give you the timeline, my first real job was as a personal trainer. I went to college for exercise physiology and kinesiology, and then I got a job as a trainer because I didn't really like working in a lab. You make good money, but, you know, I like working with people rather than like on someone in a clinical setting type of thing. So I was very overqualified to be a trainer, and I ended up just being really good at the sales end of things. I was selling more training than I was like making clients happy. And so my boss made me a sales manager very quickly. And so then I was doing sales for multiple clubs of his. And that's just kind of what was working and paying the bills. And I always wanted to do my own thing. I always wanted to work for myself in some capacity. I thought it was just going to be like personal training. once I established some clients and got good at it, I could do it on my own. But it ended up being a franchise location at the advisement of my father, just because he had so much experience with franchises that it made sense to do one myself. And so I don't know. I guess I will give you a caveat. I'm going to be very ADD because I did have a head injury last year that was pretty bad. So if I get like 90% through a thought and then start over, I apologize.
That's just par for the course. That's pretty much how I am all the time. So don't worry about it.
All right. Sounds good. The listeners are used to it.
I don't even remember. I already forgot what we were talking about.
Cool. All right. That sounds good. You were asking me if sales and like business management was something I wanted to do. No, I wanted to work for NASA in some capacity. My goal was to just what interested me was biology. So I studied exercise sciences, which is a combination of biology and physics, just hard focused on the human anatomy. And so I wanted to work with astronauts in the sense of like helping train them. Cause I knew that astronauts are one of those things where it's like being a professional basketball player, but there's less of them. Like you can aspire for it, but don't think it's the only thing you should work towards. So I knew that I could at least do it in some capacity, but then I started to grow up. And during college, I realized that the government kind of sucks and I didn't want to work for a government agency. So then I just kind of went towards fitness because that's what was working and it just kind of kept going that way.
Fun fact, I actually wanted to be an astronaut for like the longest time.
Like I'm hard committed to the space thing. I have a huge rocket ship tattoo on my arm.
No, I love space still and I just for the longest time I wanted to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
And I couldn't say for the longest time. I was probably like 6 or 7, but still that's a long time when you're 6 or 7. And now you must have just saw the big launch the other day.
I actually didn't, which I'm annoyed with. I'm really bad at keeping up with those kind of things, and I always watch them later.
My uncle lived right down the street from where they launch in Florida, so he will send us videos and pictures and stuff with the rocket ship taking off.
I was at Disney like 3 or 4 years ago, and I saw my first actual like rocket launch in person, and it was like a moment for me. Like we're on like a ferry going somewhere, everyone's looking at all the Disney stuff, and I'm just like, holy shit, that's actually a rocket ship.
Do you regret not pursuing that now?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, I mean, if I could have if I could have ever actually been an astronaut, then I think I would have regretted not pursuing it. But I don't believe that that was something that I would have attained, just realistically. Just because the type of person you need to be is like a pilot, and you need to have a really good memory to not screw up procedures when things happen. I looked into the logistics of being an astronaut before I made that decision, when I was like, 10 or something. Because that's just the kind of person I am. I'm going to be like, how realistic is this? Even when I was a kid. And, so I was just like, no, I don't think that's going to happen. It'd be really cool, but I mostly just want to go in space. So I'm just hoping to be like a passenger at some point. That'd be cool.
Honestly, dude, I don't think it's anywhere near outside the realm of possibility that we'll all travel to space one day.
I know, which is like, it's crazy to think of that, because hopefully I'll be around in 30, 40 years. And it's very realistic in that amount of time for commercial space flight to exist. Even if it's just like going up to the space station and then coming back, that would be crazy.
But I bet you the moon is going to turn into some kind of crazy Disneyland.
Well, that's when the sad thing is, that's when funding for NASA will start up again, is when there's a reason to compete with other countries. Like that's the only reason we went to the moon, is we're competing with Russia. We need motivation.
Well, I think with everything that Elon Musk is doing, love him or hate him, I think that he's kind of ushering in this new era of space exploration that is going to be much different than it was last time. I think it's going to be a lot less fueled by like achievement and much more fueled by like just the
progress.
to make money doing it.
Yeah.
With
Elon Musk, I like him in this. I don't like the people who worship him because he's still a human. I don't think you should ever idolize someone too much, but the only thing I'm mad at Tesla about is that I sold at 400 and it was like 1800 3 months later. But yep. I still made money on it, and I was happy in the moment. And then I looked at it again, like 2 months after, and was like, "Holy crap!"
I know a guy who bought $10,000 worth of Tesla when it first popped.
Ugh.
When it first came out, it must have been. I think he said he bought it for like $10, $10.50, $10,000 shares. Sold it at the absolute peak, and retired.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. I did that with a bunch of medical marijuana stocks. I own like 1,200 shares of like five different Canadian distribution companies because one of them is going to be the one that turns into the big one. You know,
you just hope you're betting on the Walmart of weed.
Exactly, which is it's a massive emerging market. Why would I not want to try to get in ground floor somewhere?
For sure, there's actually for someone like you, who is kind of tapped into that. Kind of like making money and like focused heavily on that.
I thought you meant marijuana. I was like, what?
No, I just mean like for someone who's like focused on business and the future and all that kind of stuff, this must be a pretty exciting time for you because there are so many new emerging markets with like stem cell research is picking back up real pretty heavy and like the medical field is doing all kinds of amazing stuff. Marijuana is emerging. Electric cars. I mean, the future is like kind of promised to be what it was in like 1950s sci-fi.
Yeah, and don't get me rolling down the EV car train because I love those things, and I'm a car guy, so it's like blasphemous. especially because now we can talk about it, but that's going to be a tangent. But this is my first season actually doing grassroots drifting in New Hampshire. And the NEDCO guys, which is the Northeast Drift Coalition. I hope I got that right.
Did you just have to check the notes?
No, that was just me sitting here going, NEDCO, Northeast? I'm literally just going to Google it, otherwise I feel like an
ass. No, I think that's
nailed
right.
It. Northeast Drift Co. Sweet. Those guys are going to be like, God damn it, Paul. So, anyway, now I can't share this to any of those people.
No, you still can. Let it make fun of you.
Yeah, it's fine. I'm the weirdo with the Volvo, so it doesn't matter. I don't even know how we got here. It's going to be one of those.
Just like pretty much all of our conversations, usually.
Yeah.
So you... You drift also? Where do you find time to do all this, first of all?
Well, I've been unemployed for a little bit. No.
I don't think when you're an entrepreneur, it's called unemployed. I think you need to think of a better term.
Fun employed. Yeah, so I've always been this is an automotive podcast, technically, right? So,
yeah.
This
podcast is whatever you want it to be.
So I was always a car guy, mostly because my grandfather and my father were both very into cars. Very different types, but my grandfather, which is my mother's dad, my namesake, he was a huge American, like, boat kind of guy. He had Lincolns and big ones, Cadillac. He loved Cadillacs. But he had everything. I remember he passed away at 99 a couple of years ago. So he lived a full life for sure. But he was definitely older when I was a kid. And so I remember taking him to an automotive museum like down the road from his place when he was in a wheelchair at that point. And he was just pointing at all the like 20s and 30s, like Studebakers and Cadillacs and stuff and being like, yeah, I had one of those. And they're all like, you know, worth $3 million now, but he like bought it when it was, you know, used 5 years old and like used it to go to the store and back from his farm.
Today's classics are yesterday's workhorses.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, he's got a story about, like, oh, I had this cat, I had to trade it for a work truck, and the guy he traded it with, like, crashed the car, like, 2 weeks later or something. He was like, I could have just had the car and the truck. And he was, come on, man. But so he used to drive me around in his Cadillac, and I got a lot of very fun, like, young, you know, below 10 years old, childhood memories. Just, like, going to the, you know, going to the dump. Like, he'd come by, because he was in his 80s at this point. He'd come by and, like, break down the cardboard and then take me to the dump, and we'd go dump. It was, like, you know, my afternoon thing with my grandpa. And I just remember driving around in the car. He didn't put music on, whatever. We just talked, and he drove around. That car was so comfy, big bench seats. And then my dad was – he had a couple of different cars when I was young, but when I was more like my teenage years, he had BMWs, and that's how I really got into BMWs. And that was I wish he had bought cheaper cars when I was a kid. So I owned a couple of BMWs. Mostly just, you know, I liked cars. I'd go to car shows and I'd drive around. I always wanted to, like, do track day stuff, but I never made that jump because it always seemed kind of unattainable. Then I started riding motorcycles for a while. I had a really fast bike that I got a bunch of tickets on. And then I sold the bike because a good friend of my dad's got run over, actually, over in Hudson by a kid who was distracted while he was driving. And so I kind of stopped riding after that, because once you start riding nervous, it's not fun anymore. And so I was, like, thinking about it too much while I was out riding, like, oh, it's Sandy there. Oh, it's people texting. You just get nervous to everybody. And I was like, yeah, it's not fun anymore. I'm going to sell my bike. So then I wanted to have a fun car, because I felt comfortable enough to have a fun car, and I bought a brand new M240, promptly went and modified it a little bit, made a little more power than stock, and then blew the motor up, which, if anyone listening to BMW guys are going to be very confused that the B58 blew up at only about, like, 400 horsepower, because that's the motor that they're putting in the new Supras that everyone's tuning. So I blew one of those up, and
how'd you do that?
Well, BMW determined that it was a casting defect in the second cylinder, so it cracked because of a defect. But the problem was, it was operating outside. It was exacerbated by operating outside of OEM parameters, which is their legal way of saying that I added more boost than I should have.
It was their legal way of saying that it's not warranted.
Yeah, correct. So basically what happened is I had an intake and exhaust, and it was running a little crappy on the top end. So I got I don't want to throw a company under the bus, because, you know, it really wasn't their fault. It was really the car. So it was basically a 93 octane tune, because we have 93 up here. So it allowed the engine to run a little richer, which is actually safer for the engine. And so it ups the boost just a little bit, because it wants the AFRs to be a little bit different. And so it was making maybe like 3 or 4 PSI above stock, which those things, people at the time, 2 years ago, were making 500-600 horsepower on stock internals with, like, upgraded turbo. So I was thinking, like, oh, I'm being really conservative. Sounds nice. It actually ran nicer with the tune, just because it ran a little smoother, because I think it was being fueled properly for the airflow differences, because I changed the airbox. So it was running with more airflow, and I wanted to, you know, make up for that with a tune, which is technically a smart thing to do. But BMW decided that, you know, they didn't want it to be a whole thing. So they comped half the parts. And I think that was their way of being like, yeah, we fucked up, but also we could just go after you. So let's try to keep this customer by giving them half off, you know, then, but half off of an already large 5-figure number is, not fun. So
no, I would imagine not. Yeah. Did you have the option to just take the cash and run?
No, because I was leasing the car.
Oh, no.
So the goal I had.
You were leasing that car?
Okay,
you
hold
fool.
Because you know I'm not an idiot for these things. Except this car. I had negotiated a very good residual value, and I knew that these cars were going to end up holding their value, because I had heard from some friends I know that they were going to be using that drivetrain in the new Supra. So, and they have held their value very well. And if the car didn't blow up, I would have made a very wise decision. but what happened is the car, obviously, the motor blew up. But because they comped the parts, and I had to repair it. You know, I had to fix it. Otherwise, it's, you know, just sitting there, and it's worth less money than it is repaired. And I did the math and talked to a few people, and it was worth repairing it. And then just, I figured at that point, I'd have them put a new motor in, and then I would just buy it out, because I just got a free motor at 15,000 miles, and I had beat the piss out of that car. So I was like, you know what? I got a free motor swap. Sort
of. Sounds like you're getting about another 15,000 miles out of it.
Yeah. So I figured I'd drive the crap out of it till the end of my lease, because I still had lease payments. And at that point, I needed to put a ton of miles on it, because it took months to get it fixed. And so I was like, you know what? I'll keep the car, drive the crap out of it, and I'll decide when I get to the lease end whether I want to buy it out, because I'll still have a good residual value. And the motor rebuild is not on the Carfax. I know that because when they sold the car, they didn't say anything happened to it. which will come into play soon. But so I got the car back, and then 700 or 800 miles later, I was driving down to Boston with my girlfriend in the car, and there was a bunch of construction, as happens at, like, you know, 7, 8 p.m. I was going down to visit my brother, and I stopped for traffic, you know, safely, good amount of room in front of me, and a girl behind me was texting, and she hit the back of me doing probably like 60, because she hit her brakes like, you know, 70, 80 feet from my car. It was actually, I ran a dash cam, which I learned to do from riding motorcycles. And I have the video, once again, pending legal stuff. So, because I am going after her for it. So no one can see the video yet. But I do tell my girlfriend we're getting rear-ended before it happens, because I saw the headlights dive. I was like, oh, she's coming in. Like, I never saw the slowdown. And I was kind of like, we're going to get rear-ended. And then the headlights dove, and we got hit. And I was like, oh, awesome. So
was that a head injury you were talking about?
Yeah, I got a real solid concussion from that. I tore my right knee, messed up my ankle, and real bad whiplash. I already had kind of a bad back, and I was finally at a good place with it, and it's been real junk for the last year after that accident. And now I have, like, a bunch of other little stuff that had happened. I didn't go to the hospital right away because adrenaline and, you know, whatnot. So I told the police officer in the report too, I was like, I'm going to feel like shit. I know it's because of adrenaline, but I don't feel like I'm going to die. So I don't think I need to take an ambulance. And I was like, I'll probably go to a hospital later. And I told him that. And he was like, okay. I was like, I'll go to the hospital if I don't feel good. But, like, you know, I think I'm not bleeding out or anything. I don't think I should go. Just because in the United States, you know, ambulance rides $1,500. I had one earlier that year. So we went to the hospital later, and it was, yeah, they're like, you're messed up, man. So I ended up going to a neurologist. I did like 6 months of physical therapy. What ended up happening was, and this is kind of the demise of the fitness clubs, is it was in October of 2019, because it was a year ago. And that was like my concussion being like, I don't remember that whole month. True. I don't remember a lot of details of it, but
you've not had a good year. This has not been a good year.
It's been a rough year. This is the beginning. We're just getting into it. So I get to vent, so it's fine. So I had a bad enough concussion that when I tried to do anything, like if I tried to lift, I was training clients at the gym and stuff. So if I tried to get my heart rate above 100, I'd vomit and almost pass out for about 4 months. So it was really difficult for me to do physical therapy when I would have to constantly go into the quiet room at the therapist. And so that was fun. I ended up hiring a manager, a kid that I had on part-time. I bumped him up to be a manager because I needed someone at the club. And so I took on more payroll. I wasn't there as much. Obviously, sales are going to suffer when I'm not there because it's a small facility. It wasn't a massive gym where I got, you know, 40 employees. I only had like 2 or 3 people.
Well, you were also working between 2 gyms at that time, right?
No. The first gym we ended up closing, we had talked to the town, had an offer in on a building to actually buy on Amherst Street, which is like down the road. We had an architect lay everything out. We got it approved by corporate so that the building would pass their needs. And then also we got the town to approve an extension on the building so that we could do put like functional area in the back and actually have it be a new building, because the first location, someone else bought the plaza out, so we had a new landlord mid lease, and then Sports Authority was our anchor tenant. They got bought out by Dick's Sporting Goods and they just liquidated that location. So the plaza died. We had no foot traffic and we were like, all right, we're going to leave. So we were trying to buy another building instead of leasing again, so that if I was going to do a whole build out again, it'd be worth it. And there was a tenant, it was a duplex. I would have had a tenant that would have been paying me commercial rent, and it would have been a fantastic situation. And we had like tens of thousands of dollars into architecture work and all this stuff ready to go. And the guy sold it out from under us to someone that offered to buy two buildings from him as like a package deal. So then we had like 3 months to figure it out. We just ended up closing the gym in Amherst because my Hudson Club that I had just opened had a massive flood because the landlord didn't shut the sprinklers off in the unit next to us over the winter that was vacant. So it flooded my entire new gym. So I had my old gym getting swept out from under me and I had to close. And then my new gym got flooded. So we had to get rid of all of the flooded new equipment and move like the old equipment over. It was a nightmare.
To everybody listening, like I've been following this as it's been happening. So my timeline is a little bit messed up because like, obviously I'm not Paul and like, this isn't my whole life, but like all of this has been going on for quite some time. And one thing I will say is Paul has like, you've never seen someone stay so positive when things are going so like sideways. Like you talk to him and he'd be like, you know, cause we don't talk all the time. And I'd like talk to you like once every couple months and you'd be like, oh yeah, you know, like I got this huge fucking head trauma and then now like my dick's closing. But like, whatever, I just got like something else coming.
Almost died. That was fine.
Yeah. You're just like, you're always able to handle these things like really, really well. Is that just like something that you've always had, or is it just like, because you always have a plan? Why is that?
Well, what's the alternative?
Yeah.
Is the alternative worse? Like, you know, just being bummed out about it and not doing anything? That sounds terrible. So, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm not the most positive person inward, I think. I do project it a little bit just because you have to be positive. But at the same time, I don't know. It's my father definitely instilled work ethic in me when I was a kid. He made a lot of decisions, despite him being successful, that I think raised me and my brothers to be very responsible and understand that, you know, nothing's really a given. You got to work your ass off no matter what. And, you know, it's all, I just take it as a learning experience. And that's kind of one of the biggest thing he taught me was that everyone's going to mess up. You know, everyone makes, it doesn't matter how experienced you are, you're going to fuck up. You're going to do things wrong. It's whether you get annoyed by it or you take it as a learning experience, and it's a way to get better at what you're doing. And so my frustration with closing the gym due to COVID is definitely there. But I think that despite all the money I've lost because of it, I believe that I'm going to make that money back in the future by making better decisions.
And this sounds like complete BS to everybody listening because they're like, there's no way that this guy's this calm about it. I can honestly tell you when was the first time, when did we talk? Like about a month ago now? So me and Paul talked like a month ago and he like kind of, we were just chatting and he like laid all this out. And no lie, I was like, dude, that really sucked. And your very first next sentence was, oh no, dude, I learned a ton.
Yeah.
No, dude, it's fine. I learned a whole bunch. I was wow, Paul, that is that's an attitude. That's a whole life attitude right there.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like, I couldn't do that. I'm like, no lie, I consider myself to be a positive person, and that would have fucking, like, every way you had told me, I was like, yeah, no, that would have done it for me.
That's my line. I'm right. That's crossed the line. Too much.
I would have just got a job at McDonald's at that point.
No, you know what? Job at McDonald's sounds like actual hell to me. That's the thing. The reason why I work so hard is because I hate working. that makes sense. I don't know.
Do you hate the idea of working for other people?
No, I just hate the idea of working a job that's either unfulfilling or even just unfair. Because if you're self-employed, you get what you put into it. You could work for someone and, like, take any nurse right now. They're all being underpaid. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good of a job they're doing. They're not getting fair compensation. When you're self-employed, yes, stuff happens outside your control, but you're generally going to get what you put in. And that's what I like about doing my own thing, because I'm allowed to take a day off, and I know that I'm sacrificing some income probably to do it, but that's my choice, and I can do it whenever I want, which is also nice. But I also know that I'm not going to have someone holding me to a standard unnecessarily. Like, it's really not working for someone I don't like. It's working for your average person that I don't like, if that makes sense. Like, most bosses kind of suck. If bosses were great, I wouldn't mind. But I just don't have the patience for that. You know, like, the realistic version of a 9-to-5, what actually happens 9-to-5, is terrible. Because most people that work 9-to-5, some jobs, for sure, you're working all day and you're working your ass off, like a nurse, for sure. But a lot of 9-to-5s, you're saying, like, you know, McDonald's. I'm sure some locations it's crazy, but other locations you might just be sitting there all day doing nothing. You know, I know people who work jobs where they are just on their phone on Facebook, and I know because they post it, they're just doing nothing. They're like, oh, man, can't wait until I can get out in 3 hours. And I'm like, I would just kill myself. I would never – the amount of time that I could be productive doing either fun or useful things, it just isn't worth it. I'd rather just sell everything and live in a van than to just do a job that is fulfilling nothing for me or anyone else.
And how do you bring that attitude to being a boss for other people?
It's difficult because I think I'm good at being an entrepreneur and I'm good at being self-employed, but I'm not the best at managing people. So I never considered myself a great boss, but that also I have had people tell me I'm a good boss because I don't think I'm a good boss because I'm trying to get better at it, but which is weird. But I don't know. I kind of lost what you said there. I apologize.
No, that's okay. I was just saying, like, how do you take that kind of attitude of, like, I would hate, you know, I hate the idea of people just, like, punching a clock or doing this. Like, how do you take that and then be the boss of other people when, like, you know
So there's certain things you can do. You know, there's a lot of standard practices in just business in general that's just inhuman. A lot of the ideas I actually got from my father, just because he is a very good boss. He was very good at managing people. That was his strongest suit is he is good with people, and that's my weakest point. And so I've always just tried to – I'll bring him up a lot purely because I learn a lot from him because he's good at what I'm not good at. So I'm able to be like, okay, which it took me a while to realize that, which, you know, stubborn when you're in your early 20s. But
it's a tough pill to swallow, too, when you think you know everything, but you got to – then you got to ask your dad. Trust me, it happens all the time.
Well, I look up to my dad, so I don't mind so much. But
no, I do too, but you still don't want to admit. You still don't want to admit.
Yeah. Now that I'm 30, I'm fully open in admitting that he knows way more than me. But that's fine. When you're 23 and you open a business, you're like, oh, yeah, this is great. Hot shit. Nah, not really. But so, yeah. I don't know.
So you'll bring, like, your dad into – and what will
okay.
You,
so – sorry, that's some concussion fun right there.
Okay. I used to box, so I know.
Just remind me, we're good. Yeah, I used to punch people for fun and get punched back, you know, between MMA and karate as a kid. Like, since I was 5, I did martial arts of some kind. And then I got a bunch of extra concussions when I'm an adult. Which is awesome. I had another bad car accident in college. But anyway, so one of the things you can do, just as an example, instead of doing 50 things, because it's taking me 5 minutes to answer this question, is
that's great. Longer podcasts do better.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to put my lawyer voice on.
There
so,
you go.
This is my attorney voice. So what you do is – for instance, personal days. A lot of jobs have sick days, and then they have personal days, and then they have, like, you can call out of work, but it needs to be a good reason. Those provide stress and between an employee and a boss. So if you need to tell me you're sick, it's almost like, I don't want to tell them I'm sick, because it's like, because some people, I've known a lot of people in my life personally that hate calling in sick, even if they're like dying. And they're like, I'm only going to call in sick because I don't want to get anyone else sick. But like, they would work anyway if they could. And that's just like, it's kind of awkward. Personal days is difficult because then you're differentiating between the two. So what ends up happening is people don't want to use their personal days because they'll usually plan 3 to 5 of them in a row to take a vacation. So if they need a personal day because, let's say, their relationship isn't going well and they had a terrible night and gotten a bunch of arguments or something, or their spouse is abusive, or you have no idea what's going on in someone's life. Shit happens and people have stressful things going on at home sometimes. So I don't want them to have to lie to me that they're sick or that, I don't feel good, so I can't come in at like 3 a.m. when they realize that they're going to be terrible at work tomorrow. I'd rather them just say, I need to take a personal day. And then I'm just like, okay, no problem. Everyone's allowed a set number, depending on how much you work or what you're doing, number of personal days. You don't have to give me a reason. You don't have to give me an excuse. You don't have to give me notice. You don't get a lot of them, but at least you get, I'd usually give them 3 or 4 of those. Then you have general days off where you're not going to get paid. But I will pay people for personal days. And it just makes it much, much smoother. And I can cover anyone's job. That's the big thing to be a good manager. You have to be able to do everybody's job. So if someone needs to call out, that's my responsibility. I own the place. I'll cover for you so you can deal with your shit.
No, that's an awesome, point, and especially coming from you saying that as opposed to because you hear a lot of employees say stuff like that, but it doesn't always get through to the people above them.
Yeah.
So hearing you say that, it carries a lot of weight, and I think, like you said, nobody wants to be like the asshole that called in sick.
Yeah.
Nobody, and honestly, people don't want to be the person who just took a day off for fun either.
And sometimes, sometimes you need it. Sometimes
no, totally. But I think historically speaking, it's just frowned upon. We kind of have this idea that we should be working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I'll be honest, at the end of if I take 2 weeks of vacation, so I get 2 weeks of vacation every year. If I take both those weeks at the same time, by the end of that second week, I just feel like such a useless piece of garbage. I'm just I haven't produced anything. I haven't done anything for the last 2 weeks except vacation, you know?
So that's how I would feel every day going to a job 9 to 5. You understand, huh?
No, that's a good point. But I get, I get what you're saying. That's interesting.
Yep. So I'm just going to tie in what we were talking about before that segued into this. So after
do my job for me.
Yeah, after the car accident, I was unable to go to work for a few months. I just could not go. Neurologist said, stay home, don't go to work. And I was like, oh, fine. But I went to work a few times, and I ended up needing to, wear special glasses because of all the fluorescent lighting in a commercial gym. Otherwise, I would just get nauseous and pass out, which is real fun the one time that happened. So I was only really able to come back to the club around January of last year. And so it was in a diminished capacity, so I wasn't able to do a lot. We had an average January, which, we needed a good one after me not being there for a while. Then February.
Just to be clear, January is the big time for gyms. That's why you said that.
Yes. January will do 35% of our entire year's gross revenue in 1 month, just because of all
the way that those contracts are set up. It will carry those generally when you join a gym, you get a 12-month contract. So you'll sign on people and then they'll carry through. So that's kind of January and early February pretty much sets your year.
Yeah. Sets the pace for the entire year. Yep.
Yeah.
And, it went okay. And then I was, because of my head injury, I had been talking to my father about selling the business because he was still a partner. And I got to the point where I realized that because of where I was at with my head, and I had been responsible with my finances and I had savings, and if we sold the place, I could kind of cash out. We own all the equipment outright. we were basically breaking even. We weren't like losing a bunch of money or anything. So the club was inherently worth a solid six figures. So we started to shop the club before I even came back, actually, in around like December. We put it up for sale. And we had an offer on the club, which was pretty decent. And I flew down to Florida in February. You can kind of see where this is going. I flew down to Florida in late February to do the deal and you know, meet in person with my father because he was down there. And so we met. It was a good – everything went well. It seemed to go as well as it could have gone. Everything went smoothly. We agreed on a number, and it was all good. I signed my end of the paperwork. So did my dad. And we sent it over to the guy who was buying it. And then all the COVID stuff started to come out like 2 days later. So he wanted his attorneys to look through it. He was just doing his due diligence, which you can't blame someone for doing. He was looking through, making sure we weren't being sneaky with anything. And then COVID hit, and I flew home just because that's when my flight was. And I got COVID on the plane. And I got home, and I quarantined myself just in case because everything had just come out. And I was like, I got to get home. You know, like I got a business to run, and I got to get home and, you know, get on with my life. And it was, if I sit around here, it's only going to get worse. And I already have a flight tomorrow. So you know what? I remember having this conversation because the news was starting to talk about COVID. And I'm like, in my head, talking to my girlfriend about it. I'm like, all right, I'm going to come home. You know, we're going to keep my flight. It'll be okay. I was a little worried about it going there even, you know, just because I'd heard some stuff. I couldn't get a mask because that was when everyone started buying masks. And I was like, oh, I'll be okay. I'll just be careful and hand sanitize. I got back.
We should take a minute to also acknowledge that, because I think a lot of people forget, but like when this first happened, like this was in a lot of people's minds literally the end of the world.
So yeah, like we're all kind of numb to it right now. Yeah, this was like day one COVID.
Yeah, February, this is like everybody was in full-blown panic and nobody knew like the future of humanity. This is when they still had like the 5 or 6% death rate, or like what was it, like a 10% death rate or some. Like,
yeah,
number.
It was, I remember because we saw it on the news, it was when Italy started to get really bad.
Yeah.
And that's when we were watching the news, and I was like, oh, that's concerning. And I remember talking to my parents about it. And then later that night, I talked to my girlfriend and was like, I got to get home soon. Because, like, I'm worried about being on the plane way more than I was coming here. Because now it's seeming like not great. Because I'd been there for like 4 or 5 days. So I was like, oh, this seems bad. I should come home, like, soon. And I was getting worried about it. So I got home, and I quarantined myself, luckily, for a week. And I felt fine for the first 6 days. And then the seventh day, exactly a week after I landed, I got super sick. Like, it felt like – you ever have runner's lung? Like, you go running when it's, like, 10 degrees out?
Yep.
And your lungs are just on fire for 3 days?
Yep.
It felt like I was – I had runner's lung, and I was trying to, like, chain smoke a pack of cigarettes. Like, I was just – it felt like chemical burns, like, in the top of my chest. And I remember looking into the physiology behind how it, like, spreads within your lungs. And it does start up in the upper respiratory tract, and it works its way down. That's when it gets bad. And I remember feeling it move a little bit. Like, the next morning I woke up, and it hurt, like, an inch lower, and being like, oh, that's bad. I definitely have COVID. So I tried to get a test. And this was when no one had tests and everything was just a shit show. So it took almost a week for me to get a test because Dartmouth Hitchcock was like, yeah, go here. Oh, no, we don't have them there anymore. Please go here. We don't have them there anymore either. We'll call you. And then they never called me. And I was like, hey, what's going on? They're like, we don't have a date. What? They're like, we don't have any tests. And I was like, oh, good. Do you plan on getting any at any point? Are you, like, waiting on them? And they were like, we don't even know where they're going to be, because they were going to be in Nashua, which is where I live. But now they're going to be in, like, Lebanon, Dartmouth Hitchcock up there. And I was like, okay, well, that's 2 hours from me. Like, that seems, what? No, I'm not traveling while I think I have COVID. What? I have a small bladder. I'm going to have to stop to pee and kill, like, 9 people's grandmas. It's not going to happen. I'm staying home. And so eventually my girlfriend, being a nurse, was like, I'm calling Convenient MD. I was like, why didn't we just – so she called them, and they were like, yeah, you can come get a test. I was like, are you kidding me?
They were like, we're so contest. Nobody's coming here. Nobody's thinking to call
us. No, they were slammed, but they were like, you can come tomorrow at like 3 p.m. or something. So I went, we got the test, whatever. And then everything was so backed up, we didn't get the test back for another week and a half. I was totally fine at this point, but I was quarantined because I didn't know.
Yep.
So I'm just like, okay.
Same thing happened to my wife where we, or not the exact same thing because she didn't have it, but they, me and her both had to be out of work for like a week and it was like a long time, a week and a half or so.
Yeah.
Because we couldn't get her test results back.
Well, that's what happened. My girlfriend's a nurse. She had to be quarantined the whole time I was doing this. I felt terrible.
Oh, that's right.
She wasn't working. And then she got sick, actually, like later that week, because she got all fever from it. She suddenly had like 104. It was crazy for like an afternoon. And I, you know, called and was like, I probably am going to bring my girlfriend to the ER because she has really bad fever, but I'm waiting on a COVID test. What am I supposed to do? And they basically were like, don't come here. And we were like, what? And they were like, ride it out. See how she does. Call us. Like, if she's going to die, if you really think she's going to die, you know, bring her here. But otherwise, don't. I was like, okay.
Cool.
But she ended up being okay, luckily.
Yeah. No, COVID is crazy because, like, I right after COVID kind of came out, I did a live video with someone who had had it.
Yeah.
And they work, I want to say it was at an airport. But, he was, like, telling the live video, like, yeah, no, I thought I was going to die.
He was lot of that was just the amount of pain. Like, I was able to function okay, and it was kind of light breathing, but I have good cardio, so I think that definitely helped me. Being in shape, weirdly enough, is good for you.
I don't believe it.
Yeah, you have no idea. No. I don't believe it. Oh, my God.
No way.
I can see how, like, I thought I was going to die, too, for, like, there was a good 2 or 3 hours the second day. It was right after I woke up. And I was like, because you're still worse in the morning when you're sick. And I was like, oh, shit, I might die. This really hurts.
He said he was like, he couldn't breathe. And he was just in his daughter's, he had moved into his daughter's bed to, like, quarantine himself. And
oh my God.
He was like, he couldn't breathe. And he was like, he said online, he was like, yeah, I didn't think I was going to survive.
Yeah. I definitely had a moment or two like that. And then I was, like, fine. Another, like, the next day, I felt twice as good as I did the second day. And, like, probably a little better than the first day. So I was like, oh, I'm on the up. I'm upswing. Excellent. Yeah, I
feel
like
that.
Have
you had any long-term residuals?
No, not really. I do know someone that, like, lost almost all sense of smell because of it. I forget what they always smell, but it's something annoying.
Have you ever seen the movie Dewey Cox? Walk Hard with Dewey Cox?
I have, but I wouldn't remember most of it.
That's like a major thing about his character is like he can't smell, and they like bring it up.
Oh.
I don't know. They call it smell blind. I don't know. You have to read it, or you have to
smell
it.
Blind.
It's hilarious. You should go back and watch it. But yeah, he's like, he comes in when they're smoking weed in one of the bathrooms, and they're like, we're smoking weed, dude. Can't you smell it? And then they like zoom way in on his face. He's like, no, I can't.
I remember that scene because he was like, is it bad for you? No. Is it addictive? It has no addictive quality. Yeah, see, I remember some of it.
Yeah, that was I loved that movie. That
it's
was like
non-habit for me. He's like, all right, give me some of that.
Or when he's like doing he goes in and they do him like crack or whatever, and he's like, I want some of that shit. And they're like, you don't want none of this.
You don't want none of this doing.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, it takes all your bad feelings and turns them into good feelings. I don't know. You're making it sound pretty good.
I mean, it kind of is what drugs do. It's just not for long.
I've never done drugs, so I wouldn't know.
That's the problem.
I can't fully appreciate those jokes. You can't fully appreciate those jokes until you do meth.
Hmm. Have you ever seen the comedy special Meth Piss?
No.
So it'll be your favorite thing in the world. I'll send it to you after this.
Okay, please do.
Yeah. If anyone who hasn't seen it, look up Comedy Special's Meth Piss. I forget the woman's name, but yeah, it's about her becoming addicted to meth and drinking meth piss.
It's
one of the most well-delivered, it's a fantastic bit of comedy. She performs it perfect. Every bit of the story is like, if you like comedy, she nails everything on it. And it's such a crazy story, and it's only that good because it's true. It's nuts. It's fantastic.
You convinced.
It's one of the only things I've rewatched. I do not rewatch movies or shows all that much.
You convinced me. I'll definitely check it out.
Yeah, it's so good.
So you came back from COVID and you got passed, and then what happened?
Yeah. So then the doctor called me like a week and a half after they finally did the test, which was like 3 weeks after I got sick in the first place. And he was like, "Hey, your tests are inconclusive. I don't know. I'm sorry." I was like, "Oh, awesome." He goes, "But it sounds like you had COVID. So we're just going to assume you did. And if you're still within that quarantine time, please do that. If you'd like to get retested in the future, you can certainly do that. But we're pretty sure that, like, because you got tested so late into it, that you would have, it would have been a false negative anyway.
Scientific doc. Thank you.
Yeah, I was like, oh, excellent. I'm like, I understand most of what, like, I understand how labs work. Like, I know that you probably were sitting on that sample for like 3 weeks. There's no way it was sampled perfect the whole time. And like,
labs, the McDonald's.
Yeah, so I donated, I plan to donate for the antibody, like, testing and stuff. But I haven't gotten out of the house to do so all that much, so. I've been busy, okay? I've been drifting old Volvos.
And they break down a lot, so it requires
a lot.
They
really don't. That's why I like old. That's why I don't drive BMWs anymore.
Look, you don't have to come white knight in Volvos. I was just kidding.
There was one time where I accidentally ran my drift car dry with no oil for about 3 minutes worth of cumulative burnouts before I noticed it had no oil in it, and it's fine. That's why I love old Volvos. The wiring is garbage. It's awful, and all the sensors break and relays are crappy, but man, those motors are like tractors. It's fantastic. Don't go down that road. We're gonna lose some people because I'll start.
Yeah, we're getting lost already. Hold on, let's go back. I want to finish this part about you get the test, and then you're back in the gym, but everything is not going well.
Well, yeah. So by the time all that mulled over, it was March, and I was only back in the gym for like a week and a half before we were mandated closed by the state. So between my car accident and COVID, like actually getting and quarantining because of it, and the amount of time it took for me to get my tests back, I was really only at the gym for like 7 or 8 weeks between October and when we were forced closed. And so then, being closed, I furloughed my employees, you know, myself even, just kind of tried to figure out what we were going to do. Because what happened was, at first, a lot of our members wanted to pay. They were like, "We want you to stay open. We understand. It's, you know, like $35 a month. I'm not worried. I'd rather this place still be here because we don't know how long it's going to be closed." And those are like great members. Those people are fantastic. And what ended up happening was, is our company that we use for payment processing got sued. They're a very large company, and everyone knows who they are if you've ever worked in a gym. And they got sued in California, and they shut the entire company down just to be safe because there was some shenanigany billing where someone who was an attorney got billed by his gym when he told him not to, while they were closed for COVID. And so he just opened a class action on the company that processed the billing. And we all got shut down. Every Anytime Fitness. Oh, awesome. Every Anytime Fitness. Doesn't matter at this point.
We were doing so good.
We
I was
were
trying
doing
to
really good.
How to not to say the other company's name, too.
Well, you know what? No. It's fine. I haven't said anything. Every Anytime Fitness, Planet Fitness, Gold, a couple of local gyms, Power, I think Powerhouse, and LA Fitness. All of those companies used this same billing company. So I technically haven't said anything yet.
All right.
And all of those companies were not allowed to bill anyone for anything, like with a 3-day notice. So we just had our entire revenue source just cut. And then we were closed for another like 4 months. So I'm still paying utilities. I'm still paying rent. So we had to stop paying rent because I couldn't afford it. And then once we finally could reopen, there was too many financial pressures between everything. And then also just the prospect of the industry being very, very slow over the next couple of years and where we were now at. Because to finish up what I was saying before, obviously the sale of the club fell through. Once COVID happened, the guy backed out. And so we explored options. We had like 3 or 4 other times that we thought we were going to get a deal to happen. It just never happened with anyone. And so we were willing to take like half the money we originally wanted and just didn't happen. So we ended up closing. And
were you able to get any kind of help from like the franchise owner or like the corporate?
Franchisor. So the corporate continued to bill us for franchise fees.
They still billed for franchise fees even though they weren't able to be open?
Yep.
And they're probably like a multi-billion-dollar company?
Oh, definitely. They just built a – yep. 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 They gave us like half off, but they made the stipulation – because it was a flat rate. They made the stipulations very weird, and I only got like 2 months of half rate. So I only saved like a very relatively small amount of money. And then the SBA loans that everyone was talking about, like, oh, well, didn't you get your, like, stimulus money from the government? Well, those are based off of payroll. That's it. It's only based off your payroll. And so they were basing it off my entire last year worth of payroll, where until October, I was doing a lot of the management. So I had no management on payroll, really. So my payroll numbers were not that high. And we ended up getting, like, like $20,000 or something. And then we were only allowed to use like 25% of it on rent. So what I ended up doing was instead of furloughing my employees, I rehired them while we were closed and just paid their salaries so that we could use the money legitimately. And at least they would benefit off it because then they could collect unemployment longer once we reclose, if we do, or if we run out of SBA money, because we didn't know if we were ever going to reopen at that point. So I just figured I'd pay everyone's salary for an extra 2 months if I could, just because otherwise I can't use the money. I can't pay myself any more than my base salary already was, so I paid my salary as well out of it for like 6 weeks. But I paid everyone and was like, okay, well, I guess we get an extra 6 weeks of unemployment basically, and that was it. That's all I got help-wise. There was no real other stimulus that affected the fitness industry. Or small businesses that would apply to what I was doing.
And what was your mental state like at this point? Because I mean, I'm sure that like we were just kind of saying like you'd been having a rough year already. Were you feeling it, or was that just kind of that optimism still there, or what was going on?
Oh no, I was depressed as hell. But that was a real rough time.
I would imagine.
But at the same time, I was originally planning on selling the gym. So I already had plans in place to replace that. It's just that now I had a lot less starting capital. That's really all that changed, is that I just had less starting capital than I thought I was going to have. So I'm just kind of doing what I originally was intending on doing. It's just, a little riskier because I don't have as big of a cash flow as I thought I would. But, you know.
And what are you trying to do now, Paul, with your your best shameless plug right now?
Yes, my best shameless plug. Well, the yo-yo company is a very niche hobby. So unless you feel like getting into a very niche hobby, it's similar to like juggling. It's just something where just look up World Yo-Yo Contest and you'll see the ridiculousness that is modern yo-yo.
I'm the king of obscure hobbies, Paul.
You're talking to a guy that owns a yo-yo company.
I bend steel rods. I do something called short bending, which is where you just bend metal rods.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
That's it. That's all of it. That's all it is.
Yeah. Well, that's all what a lot of people's hobbies are. If you reduce it, you know, you're just straightforward with it.
There's no way to reduce it. That's it. You just bend.
you literally just
take 6 or 7 inch pieces of steel rod and then bend it, and that's it. That's the whole hobby.
Well, I mean, it's no different than like doing strongman, which is just
for the strongman feat. That's how I actually started. That's how I got into it. Was because
that's
of
what that. I figured. Yeah, but it's the same as like being really into deadlifting. You know, like I love powerlifting. Okay, so your hobby is picking up a bar with more weight than last time. Yeah. Like if you reduce it, it's boring.
Yeah. No, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. So what would affect a larger audience, which is partly why I'm doing it. I've always had a lot of interests and a lot of hobbies. And as I said earlier, I like to make them self-fulfilling. So I've always been very into watches. It's a combination of mechanical engineering nerdiness, just because mechanical watches, which are driven purely on spring tension controlled through gears. There's no batteries or anything in mechanical watches. It's cool. I just like it. And also I'm into fashion and I'm into jewelry and I've always really enjoyed those things. So, I have always brokered high-end watches. Originally I would just buy and sell them and try to make money selling them, but it just turned into a bigger and bigger thing. And it's always been a side income for me, buying and selling, primarily Rolex, Tag, Breitling, Omega, like all the big brands. I'm starting to move higher up into other things, Cartier, Panerai, you know, AP, a couple other, you know, just all the big ones that people actually buy. I haven't bought a Patek yet. I'm not there. But I
honestly, watches are like, I've never been into watches in any way, shape, or form. I don't even like them on my body. Like, I've always just either used the wall clock or my phone.
Yeah, well, it's not for telling time. It's for appreciating art in an engineering sense. So it's the same as it's kind of like being able to take a custom car and be able to carry it around with you and be like, look at this cool little custom car on my wrist. It's just really high end engineering combined with fashion. Just, you know, if you like how it looks, I wear a watch probably half the time. I don't wear it every day. Like, I'm not wearing one right now. But, you know, I'll put one on and be at home all day and just wear it because I like it. Same with jewelry.
I have noticed that there is definitely, like, like people who are into cars, like, nice, especially the European, like, the German cars are also into watches.
There's a lot of carryover. If you're nerdy enough to like fixing difficult European vehicles, you probably like, you know, the mechanics of a watch. It's just
hate yourself enough to spend a lot of money on a watch.
Exactly. Yeah. So what I did is I was like, I don't quite hate myself that much. So, and I'd like to afford more race car parts. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to buy watches for cheaper. Like I'd watch markets, and kind of see what prices different things were at. And then when they dip a little bit, or I'd see one up for less than what I knew it was worth, I would buy it. Because I'd have a list of a bunch of watches I wanted and what they're generally worth. And if one popped up for sale on like Reddit or Facebook or whatever, just different groups, I would buy it. Or I'd haggle, which I'm very good at doing. So I would, you know, I'd haggle and buy it for a good price. I'd wear it for 6 months to a year. And then I'd sell it for more than I bought it for. So I got to wear a Rolex for 9 months and I made $300. What's the hate there? So I was able to wear a... Because what happens with consumerism is you wear something or you buy something, and 2 months later, a couple weeks later, depending on what it is, you're sick of it and you want something different. Just it's just there's no more dopamine response for that one item. So you get rid of it and you get a new one.
That's
a very, very biochemical way of breaking down hobbies. But
that's the worst thing. It's like the worst thing that can ever happen to you is you get like your dream car, you know?
That's what happened with my 240. I was like basically my dream car.
It goes from being your dream car to just being your car.
A nightmare. This is a curse. I was like, all right, I guess I'm not supposed to have a nice M car. That's fine.
Well, that could have also been because of the way you were driving it.
I was stopped when I got hit.
Oh, right. I was thinking of the one you blew up.
Same car.
Yeah, no, that's what I thought. So part of it. Yeah, no, you're probably... I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, that
manufacturing defect and then rear-ended. That's not my fault. What? So, being into that world, I know a lot of people that like jewelry or that even own jewelry stores. I'll buy watches off of jewelry stores that get trade-ins. So I had those connections already. So I started talking to people about designing jewelry because right before my car accident in September, I had gone to Greece for the first time, which my family on my father's side is Greek. We're originally from this little island called Hydra, which is spelled Hydra, like the nine-headed snake monster. And so we had stayed there, and most of the local merchants made either jewelry or art of some kind. My last name actually means artist in Greek. So it all kind of just tied in really, really sudden for me. Like I had been thinking about maybe leaving the fitness industry, that got put in my head. And then I immediately got ripped away from the gym, like after I got home and I was just thinking about being in Greece and all the different jewelry I saw and all the different people I met that had made the jewelry. And they were all fantastic. And I had a lot of good conversations with people. There's this one woman, Mary Elena, who was actually on the island of Hydra selling custom silver jewelry. And I bought two things from her. One was actually a coral necklace because they have enough there and it grows very quickly that it's sustainable and they're able to harvest coral. So I have a coral necklace that was
legal, cool.
Weird. It's very bright red. It's super cool. And then a hand-woven, just super ridiculous. It almost looks like some like Persian like lord would wear where it's like a rope chain that was hand woven. Like they literally handmade every little link of it, and just looking at it is like a rope snake chain kind of thing. And
that's crazy.
It's crazy. And so it just I love that. And I like things that people make. And I enjoy making things. That's why I design stuff. But like I just really I like working on cars, but I don't like making other stuff. I like designing things. I like appreciating stuff. So it's kind of like being an art broker when you're buying and selling jewelry, if it's good jewelry. So to me, I really have enjoyed that end of it as well. So I'm buying and selling vintage and estate jewelry because it has inherent intrinsic value just being either solid gold or silver, et cetera. So I was doing all that with the watches and whatever, and I was like, you know, if I'm closing the gym or selling the gym at the time, I should expand this. I should take the two things I enjoy doing and I'm making money on, just enjoying it, and just expand them. I'll do more yo-yo stuff, but that's within its own niche market. But on the jewelry end of things, I was able to take the experience that I had from designing yo-yos and CAD and be able to design custom pendants. So I can design custom pieces for clients and then send it to a jeweler, like an actual shop that will cast and, you know, mold and set all the stones and everything. And so I've got connections with a guy in New Jersey, a guy in New York, someone in L.A., Italy and Brazil, and I'm trying to get someone in Greece. And I'm just – there's a bunch of different places where I can source stuff from and have things made. So depending on what you want, I will pick the best person for that rather than just having one main supplier or doing it all in-house because I might not be good at certain things. I'd rather just – get good connections with the people that are really good, and then I can outsource and I can be like that center hub for each individual thing. So like the guy in New Jersey, for instance, he has a jewelry store that's a front, not in the legal front, but front
I was like, tread carefully.
Tread carefully. Where he buys gold and basically melts it. So, like, if someone comes, it's basically like a cash for gold place, but it's not cash for gold. And so people will come to him with broken jewelry or functioning jewelry or whatever, and he'll buy it for slightly under what it's worth, like melt price. He's essentially giving them what the materials are worth. And then he'll either melt it and make his own stuff out of it, or he'll sell existing, like if it's some cool custom piece from the 90s or something, because there's a lot of weird 90s gold chains out there, he'll sell it for not much more than what it melts for, and especially if you buy a couple of things. So I buy stuff from him, and then I can turn around and sell it in my showroom on the website. So I'm combining the ability to make custom pieces, which is primarily vermeil, which is basically silver jewelry. It's 925 sterling silver that's been plated with whatever gold you'd like. So it's still all precious metals. It's just not as expensive as solid gold, because that can get real expensive really quickly. And then we use mostly lab stones for the custom stuff, just because I have not found a affordable place to get stones ethically. A lot of the gem trade is very human rights violation filled, so I tread lightly unless it's used jewelry that's already existing in the market. So I like to be very aware of that kind of stuff. So my custom thing's a little more limited, purely just because I don't have the ability to do it yet. And so I'm really focused on buying and selling just cool, unique stuff. I enjoy finding weird things and sharing them with people. And I have a strange aesthetic to begin with. So I've met enough people that also share my strange aesthetic that I figured I could make kind of a business out of it. So the nice thing with jewelry is it's tight margins, but it's reliable, because you can buy a gold chain, and even if I don't sell it, it's gold. It's solid 14, 18, or it's worth its weight in gold. I have a piece right here in front of me that's about 52 grams of 10 carat. And in the time it took for them to ship it to me, it's worth more than I paid for it, because gold's been up this week. So, like, it's an enjoyable market. I have the capital to invest in it. That's the difficult thing with jewelry, is it takes a lot of capital to really, like, even get your foot in the door. But it's just, I'm really passionate about it. It's one of those things that weirdly, I never thought I'd be buying and selling jewelry. I never thought I'd be a jeweler. But being able to launch Vice Jewelers, vicejewelers.com, is...
And find them on Instagram at Vice Jewelers.
At Vice Jewelers, and on Facebook at Vice Jewelers. the cool thing is that the market, and this kind of answers a question you brought up, like, I don't know, 40 minutes ago, that... The economy is shifting. I don't believe that we're going to have a recession because we live in the internet age. I think what's happening is we're having a shift, is that things are moving towards e-commerce quicker than they already were, but they were already going that direction to begin with. It's just COVID just booted the whole economy in the ass to go towards e-commerce. Everyone just wants to buy, work from home, which is great in my opinion. Work from home, buy stuff from home, get, you know, produce and meat delivered automatically, not have to go to the grocery store. Just that's really what's happening. And so one of the things I enjoy is going to a jewelry store if I'm traveling and looking at weird, unique local stuff. And so I want to take that and put it online in my basically virtual showroom of weird stuff that I found by traveling and, you know, sourcing stuff from all over the world, is that I can kind of put that in one place without you, because no one can travel right now anyway, without anyone having to travel around and find them yourselves. If you just like weird stuff and want to buy it, I'll find it for you.
This is kind of a left turn, but what is it about, like, gold and silver that has attracted people for so long, do you think?
I think for me personally, it's that we know that there's intrinsic value in just what the material is. And so because it holds that value, it's worth more to us than, it's just a rarity thing. You know, I think
that's the weird thing, is like, what value does it really hold though? Right? Like, that's like gold and
silver.
Well,
it's the same as any commodity, you know, water's not precious, like, until there isn't a lot of it.
My, like, I don't mean like I just mean like the broader sense. Like, why do you think people originally like saw gold and then wanted it? I guess like gold is a very strange thing to me.
I can answer that somewhat accurately. So I think that my theory on it would be that we are, and this is, applies to a lot of things that humans do, is that we're just biological machines hardwired to not die. And so not enjoy anything, just not die. So, and a lot of the shit we do is so we don't die. Or that so whoever 15 generations ago, because they had this weird quirk about them, they didn't die. And you get to deal with it. That's why we're all so anxious, because if we weren't anxious about every danger around us, we probably would have died quicker. So less of us would have survived to have kids. And so all the people with anxiety had kids. And just over time, we're all anxious about everything. So anyway.
Except you, who's not anxious about anything ever.
Dude, I'm anxious about crap all the time. I just focus. That's the difference. You just got to deal with it and suck it up. Really what it is, I believe, is that we covet rare things because we have this inherent need to covet, say, well, basically resources. So water, food, shelter. If it's scarce, and if our brain knows that whatever the thing is scarce, we want to hold on to it just in case. And that's just hardwired in us, a lot of us, from generations ago, where that need to hoard something is why they survived, even if it was obsessive, and it gets watered down and enhanced depending on the person. But I believe that that over a long time is what caused people to be like, oh, gold is rare. We should hang on to that. And also it's just visually appealing. Gold, especially, have you ever seen like 24 karat gold?
I'm not going to lie. I have not.
Okay.
I don't think
so,
I have. No.
If you hold actual solid gold, that isn't an alloy of any.
Definitely
alloy.
Never touched 24 karat gold.
Well, next time I see you. That's the cool thing, is I can show people cool stuff like that. I buy and sell like little bars of gold sometimes, like just 1 ounce to 10 ounce, like bullion things.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I think that just the inherent value of that to us, you know, it's going to stay valuable just because other people do. Like, we also know that other people value gold. So we should, because we can use that as a tool. It's just the inherent, it's like currency. And to me personally, I don't trust paper money all that much, and I certainly don't trust electronic transactions all that much. Just having all of our money just be numbers in the abyss that hopefully banks honor at some point. So having actual valuable things is very useful. Nowadays, gold is valuable because gold is a very good conductor, and we use it in lots of things. So we need gold for stuff, and it's not just used for jewelry anymore. And so
that's the thing that I found so interesting about gold, like as a resource, is it's like we've loved it, and like humans have like fought wars over it for
mm-hmm.
centuries, and like we've only just recently found like a non
useful
like a non-decorative like use for it. Like that's what I think is so strange about like precious metals like that. It's like it's only recently that we've figured out that they're any useful for anything, you know?
Yeah, well, most of the inherent uses of gold or other precious metals have to do with electricity conductiveness or lack thereof, depending on what it is, as well as like insulating properties. And we just didn't know about those things.
Well, and lack of corrosion is the other thing that's like
yes.
that gold doesn't corrode.
Yep.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, you're good. I think that and plus such a small amount is worth so much. You know, you can hold in your hand thousands of dollars worth of gold pretty easily. So it's interesting to just be like, oh, it's not like a big stack of hundreds, which you'd be like, oh, cool, there's a lot of cash here. But to just hold something, it's like holding a diamond ring is worth inherently a ton just because of what people – that's a whole different thing. The gold industry is different than the diamond industry. I try to – as much as I love jewelry, I'm trying to step back a bit from diamonds just because it's such a dirty industry. So we can dive down that if you want me to.
Yes, sir. Go for it.
All right. So, do you know the history behind the pricing of diamonds?
I do not.
So
why would I?
Why would you not?
I'm about to.
Yeah. So basically what happened, the quick version, because this could be like a 3-hour thing. The quick version is that diamonds were very plentiful. So one company De Beers decided to just buy all the diamonds, just all of them. Whoever was selling them, they just bought all the diamonds. And then they hoarded all of them. And then they would just sell them in controlled bursts. And that was where they controlled the market.
I do know this story that you're about to tell, I think.
Yeah. So we'll do the real condensed one. So then another company, I think it was in Australia, they found a huge mine that was almost the size, it was like a third of the world's diamond supply that they knew they were going to be able to get. And so they wouldn't sell to De Beers. And so what ended up happening was then there was a little bit of competition. So there was the brand recognition of De Beers, and now they weren't able to control the market, and they had a ton of diamonds. So they were like, well, we don't want to just sell all of them. That would be terrible and just tank the market. So they talked to a bunch of different advertising firms. And there was one advertising firm that basically nailed it, and they spent like about a decade just inundating the American people with the idea that a diamond engagement ring is inherently a good thing to do, and it's something that you should aspire for, and the value of it was not set as a set amount. It wasn't like you should spend $3,000 or you should spend, you know, whatever. It was, I believe at first it was 2 months' salary. So it was able to be proportional to what your work was, so everyone could afford one, because it was no matter who bought the diamonds, it was 2 months' salary. So it was equal no matter how much you made in what you were showing your spouse that you were committed to them. Even if it was a meager diamond, it was still 2 months' pay. And so it just blew up, and they started to be able to sell diamonds for a ton of money, because then they just started jacking the prices up and still controlling as much as they could. They didn't just give up when the other place started, you know, selling their own diamonds. But essentially, they artificially inflated the market to the point where they had way more diamonds than were actually in the market, and were able to just say, oh, no, they're super rare. There's shitloads of diamonds. It's just they said they were super rare. It got to the point where during, I believe, World War II, might have been World War I, I apologize if I'm screwing that up, the U.S. government was like, hey, we need those diamonds for, like, technology things. Like, we need them for
technology stuff.
Yeah,
guys, all the technology stuff.
We need them for technology stuff. And I don't want to screw it up and say the wrong thing, so I'm just going to say technology stuff. But I know that the government put pressure on De Beers. They were like, we want to buy a bunch of your diamonds. And they were like, no. Like, we're not going to just release a ton of our diamonds. Like, go away. And it turned into a whole thing and whatever. And so the market just is muddied with not only diamonds that have come from tons of human rights violations, just because the inherent value of them for the few people that could get diamonds that wasn't De Beers, because the market was so high, they would do crazy shit for them, but also just the market itself is just ugh. And so I've tried to kind of stay away from the natural diamonds just because it's crazy. And I don't know that market super well yet. But I do definitely enjoy the custom solid precious metals, and gems are also really cool. But those are a little rarer and fewer and far between. So,
yeah, I never, I honestly don't know almost nothing about gems, but I have always been confused as to why people dislike lab produced gems. It seems like you could just make better gems than you can find.
Well, that's the thing is,
randomly in the dirt.
That's the thing is, I use lab stones for most of my, not only colored, but white stones for all the custom work, especially vermeil. just because visually and essentially it is the same thing as a natural diamond or a natural stone of any other color. It's just that it was grown in the lab. And so that's really what killed the diamond market. And that's when they switched over to like all the aggressive marketing about it being real diamonds versus it being fake diamonds. Like there, it's all just been, you know, whatever. But I think that it's the same as like lab grown meat. If we could grow perfect meat that tastes exactly the same, there would still be people that are like, gross, I'm not going to eat that. The same people that would be like, I want to have a natural diamond. There's something somewhat poetic about a rock that was formed in the earth. The problem is, how is it sourced? And that's the biggest issue. Lab diamonds are all ethical.
Well, the weird thing is that it's gotten to the point. I actually watched a not a documentary, but it was like a YouTube. It was like a 20-minute YouTube video about this the other day, where someone took two lab tested stones, or one lab created stone and one non lab created stone, and brought them to like a jeweler's market in I don't know where with all these professional jewelers, and only like 50% of them were able to tell the difference, basically.
Yeah, and the main reason they probably guessed that it was a lab stone is that it was too perfect.
Probably.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, statistically, if you take a large sample size like that, normally if when it comes down to it, if it's 50-50, it means that they were just guessing, not that 50%
yep.
of the time they got right.
Yeah, or it's an outside factor. Like, the big thing with lab stones is there's no reason to make them flawed. So almost all of them are VS plus, perfect, flawless, colorless, unless made otherwise on purpose. And so a good jeweler can, even with just a lope, is just going to look, which is basically a little one-eyed magnifying glass, is just going to look and be like, this is too perfect. It was probably made in a lab. And they'll just guess lab. Because unless that guy has a perfect, flawless, colorless stone in his hand, it's probably worth like 150 grand, so he wouldn't be just using it for his little science experiment. That's the thing. It's just like, if you know the industry, you're like, this is probably lab-grown because it's too good, and this guy wouldn't have this.
But even with all that, only 50% of them were able to get it.
Yeah, because they were probably like, I mean, I don't know. You know, they're just guessing. Yeah, you're right.
Get out of here, strange guy. They probably just wanted the guy to leave.
It's
very interesting that, like, I don't know. I always thought, like, if you're gonna get someone, like, something like a nice ring or something, it would make more sense to get the one that's the most perfect. I don't know. That just the thing that makes sense to me.
That's what makes sense to me, but I also like science, so. I think it's cooler that they were grown in the lab. I was like, oh, we figured out a way to make these perfect for a tenth the price? That sounds great.
Exactly what I want.
What? Yeah. So I could buy steak for 50 cents a pound that tasted perfect every time and no animals had to die. Why wouldn't I not eat that?
Hell yeah. I'm about it. I'll eat mutant meat. I don't care.
Mutant meat. It's all mutant meat anyway. We're going
Paul?
On an adventure. I need to get another drink.
Paul,
yes.
Where can people find you?
Where can people find me?
Yeah.
Well, it'd be vicejewelers.com. Or vandalores.com, or I guess Facebook. It'd be Paul Theodore Zografos, my whole name spelled out.
Paul, thank you so much.
Or I guess if you're in Nashua, just hit me up.
What'd you say?
I said, or if you're in Nashua, just, you know, hit me up.
Just stop by.
Yeah.
Paul, thank you so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
I'll talk to you soon.
You too.
Hey, everybody, thank you so much for giving us a listen. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. If you could do me a favor, and if you're listening on Apple, if you could go and give me a 5-star review, I would really, really appreciate it. I would understand if you want to give me a 1-star review, but if you do me a favor and just let me know what I did that caused that, and if I can do anything that could make it better. I hope you guys have a wonderful day, and I will talk to you soon.